KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. My guest this week is television historian David Bianculli. David Bianculli is an authority on the art and the history of the medium of television. He's a contributor to Fresh Air and is the host of the website TV Worth Watching. We last spoke with him after the publication of Dangerously Funny, the uncensored story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. His new book is The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. It's a book that argues convincingly that the current era of TV, from The Sopranos forward, is bigger than the Golden Age because it's platinum. David Bianculli, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks a lot. Sounds funny when you say it like that. Made me laugh.
The rise of TV quality that you discuss in your book, it's kind of matched by a fall in the quality of theatrical films. Maybe the gulf between the films that are popular and well-attended and the films that are critical successes and award winners. Like in the 60s, films like A Man for All Seasons or The Graduate or The Producers, they were not only great, but they were huge successes. Whereas now, you know, far more people have seen Iron Man 3 than A Single Man or Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's actually one of my theories, and I'm not quite sure it locks in, but I think it does, and it's sort of that film kept getting better in the 60s into the mid 70s, and then we had some very good blockbusters, Star Wars and Jaws, and then all of a sudden, all the movie studios just wanted to go for the biggest pieces of the pie, so they stopped making those smaller, better, you know, movies, the Dog Day Afternoons and the Serpicos, and television started picking up the slack at about that same time by, you know, developing into cable, by becoming more nuanced, and I think it's sort of won lately by default.
And the interesting thing about creating work for television, I would think, is that, you know, and it's still, even though we now watch it on big screens and it's the same screens we watch our movies on, it's still a very different thing, television, because you have to tell your story in 52 minutes. And you have to have a story, especially now when you have the continuity in which you want to, at the end of every 52 minutes, you want it to be a satisfying episode of a show and yet still keep you going to the next one.
Right, and you know, you've also got the sort of thing where it presumes a certain amount of loyalty and intelligence is a chapter of a novel rather than a self-contained film or a sequel. It's taking advantage of the things that are inherently potentially better about television. I think it really has matured.
Well, I really love your book. It's a great book, The Platinum Age
Thank
of Television.
You.
And I had a lot of fun not only reading the book, but then, of course, digging through my stuff and watching old shows. Last night I watched that episode that you reminded me of Boston Public, in which they used the episode of The Defender, the pilot with...
What fun. Yeah, with William Shatner using William Shatner from the golden age of TV and then using him again in a TV show decades later. It's lots of fun. I'm finding out that people are actually reading the book this way, and I didn't intend it that way. They're standing there with either DVDs or streaming sites or YouTube, and when I describe something in print, they're like hitting pause on the book and going and watching it. I'm fascinated by that.
And, you know, that's a key difference in, you know, when you and I were growing up watching TV and now. That is, when we watch TV, if you didn't see it when it was on, you know, you didn't see it. There wasn't
right.
Any go back and watch or binge watch or... we didn't even have a remote control. I mean, my brother had a remote control. He would say,
"Yeah, probably for a while, your brother was the remote control."
No, I was his. You know, go turn it loud, turn the channel.
Oh, you were the younger brother.
Yes,
you were the younger brother.
Yes. but yeah. So you know, that's a completely in that way. You know, there's, I mean, broadcast television is kind of over.
Yeah, you know, here's the paradox. Is that More television is available now than ever was available before, and not just in terms of selection if you have cable or even if you're just restricted to broadcast, but the availability of all the TV that's ever been made on either DVDs or on streaming sites. You can see more of it than you ever did. And the good part about that right now is, let's say that I talk to you about Better Call Saul. And I really love Better Call Saul because I really loved Breaking Bad, which Better Call Saul is a sequel and prequel to. But let's say you haven't seen it. Well, you can go back and watch all of Breaking Bad and then all of what's been made so far of Better Call Saul before the new season begins. And this didn't used to happen. You didn't have this possibility. What drives me mad is that a lot of people aren't taking advantage of it.
What about young people? Do you think, I'm not sure that young people watch TV like we did because there are so many choices. I think they watch YouTube and they watch their phones and things.
Yes, yeah, in terms of college students, because, we're both teachers. My students, not to say that yours are the same way, but, they're about 20 years old, and mine, a lot of them are radio, TV, film majors, so you would expect them to have a great appetite for all the good TV that has come before and to be absolutely fluent on the TV that's out now, and neither one of those is the case. They respond well when I show them good things, but they're not seeking them out on their own, necessarily.
I ask my film appreciation students to write a list of their top 10 movies, so it's like the first assignment I give, and, mm-hmm. and they'll give me a list of movies that came out last Thursday.
Yeah, I don't understand. I really don't understand it. But part of it is that, and I'm really dating myself here, but you go back to, I grew up in the 60s, and that was the era of syndication. So you came back from school, and the only television that was available to watch that was interesting were old reruns from the 50s. So I saw The Honeymooners and I Love Lucy and got fluent in those shows, even though they had ended a few years before I started watching TV. And you got caught up in those the same way you got caught up in old movies at 11 o'clock.
Right.
And today's young people don't fall for that. They have their own channels from the very beginning. Disney Channel, or they can go with PBS Kids, then they go to Nickelodeon, and then they go straight to MTV. So they never have a spot where they're force-fed anything they don't think they want to watch.
Yeah, whereas when you and I were growing up, we saw, I Married Joan and Love That Bob and
yep.
Bachelor Father and all those sitcoms that had come just before we were old enough to pay attention to them.
Exactly.
And that's true with movies, too. But yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean, people, I think, now are very into the things that they're into, and they're not into anything else.
But the good part about that as a teacher, and I'm guessing you feel the same way, you tell me, is that, just last week, I was able to say how many of you have seen The Marx Brothers, and out of a class of 30, maybe 5-6 hands went up. And so I got to introduce The Marx Brothers to 25 people. That's a fun job.
I agree, yes. Although sometimes I will try that, and they won't find them funny, and then I'm baffled.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that brings me to another point. You were talking in your book, The Platinum Age of Television.
Oh, yeah, the book.
Yeah, it's all right. You were talking in your book a little bit about talk shows. Nowadays we hear a lot about a vilification of the intellectual class. I heard that phrase the other day. And it seems to me that talk shows have played into that. When you and I used to watch The Dick Cavett Show or The Tonight Show,
mm-hmm.
even The Tonight Show, when it was a 90-minute show, it always had that period at the end of the show where they had an author and they talked about books. I remember an episode of The Jack Parr Show where he had Robert Kennedy on, and they talked for like 20 uninterrupted minutes.
Absolutely, yes, yes, I have that episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
And now talk shows are always short segments that are leading up to the next joke, And this was true with Letterman and Leno, and I think it's true with all of the ones that are there, Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy whoever, that they want to tell their joke. They're listening for their opportunity to get their joke in. There are very few serious conversations, and they don't talk about books. And in fact, David Letterman used to kind of make fun of people that had written books.
Yeah, they've deconstructed it. I think that what's happening is that not only are talk shows being reduced to various elements, but those elements are sort of escaping from the talk show itself. And I think that they, in the future, may become their own talk shows. Jerry Seinfeld, Comedian in Cars, you know, Having Coffee.
Yeah,
is a talk show, really, but it's a talk show without an audience and all by itself, and they go off and they do things. You learn something about the guest, you hear some jokes, you hear some stories.
Yeah.
And Carpool Karaoke is from a talk show, but it doesn't need to be. I mean, James Corden could stop the Late Late Show and just do Carpool Karaoke, and that would be a show. It would just... it would be a shorter show. It might be a weekly series of specials, but it would probably get, you know, I mean, we know that he gets $100 million when he goes around driving with Adele on YouTube, but only $1 million when he shows it for the first time on CBS. So where's the real value there?
And the conversation is the most interesting part of those bits.
Yes, and for conversation, even though there's lots of laughs, there's actually a genuine conversation on the Graham Norton show on BBC America. So I gravitate a little bit to that right now, but I am with you 100% in missing the serious conversations. Craig Ferguson used to do that on when he hosted the Late Late Show every once in a while. But there aren't many places for authors to go. So thank you for giving me a place to go, now that I think about it.
Well, I'm happy to have you.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, you talk about this platinum age of television. And
mm-hmm.
It's interesting how the programs... When I first looked at it, I was ready to argue because, you know, I was, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, but the programs that you highlight in bold are not necessarily the best shows offered, but rather the ones that were the most influential, that led to other shows like it.
Right, and some of them go way back into TV history. They aren't from... I define the Platinum Age as beginning just about the turn of the century with Sopranos and West Wing in 1999, but in some of the five shows per evolutionary chapter that I point out, to me it's like the five stages of man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big evolution when we finally get to, you know, from Neanderthal man to Homo erectus and Homo sapiens, you know. So in family sitcoms, I Love Lucy is definitely one of them, you know, because it changed, you know, the place where they were filmed, the way they were filmed, the way they came into rerun. So it's a very significant show, even though that goes all the way back to 1951. So that's why she's in the subtitle of the book.
And, of course, I Love Lucy is still incredibly entertaining.
Yes.
And I show
the Vitamita Vegemin episode,
oh,
you know,
so
Lucy
yeah,
does a TV
yeah.
commercial.
I show it too.
I've seen that so many times, and it not only does it always work, and I still show the black and white one. I don't know if I'm going to show the one that CBS showed last year in color.
No, thanks.
I don't want to make it that easy
no.
for my students. But I am marvel at what a great job of acting that is.
Johnny Carson was once talking about the Gilligan's Island, and they were talking about colorizing them, and he said, too bad they can't humorize them. But the thing about Lucy is it's funny. I find the most interesting, I think the shows that are, you know, and we talk to a lot of people about the shows they love, and I think the shows that have stuck with me the most are the ones that would feel completely at home in the Platinum Age. And, you know, then there are some that are completely, you know, antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
Like Perry Mason, you know, it's kind of antiquated. It's like a lot of shows, and it's a major, you know, stepping stone. And but it's much more like Matlock and CSI. That is, it's enjoyable, but it's not stimulating, and it's not like The Naked City or The Defenders, which is more like The Good Wife. Those were enjoyable and engaging and had meaningful discussions of politics and controversial topics.
Yeah, see, isn't that fun? Isn't that fun to be able to pick apart those shows? Again, I think of it like Darwin, and you use these TV shows like they're fossil records.
Yeah.
And to look at Naked City or NYPD Blue and say, oh, well, look at this, feels a lot more like... you know, NYPD feels like NYPD Blue and not just in name only. But
oh, I love that show, NYPD. That was a great
yes,
show.
Yes, you know, I mean, and it's fun to go back to some of those. East Side, West Side in the early 60s is very Hill Street-y, a long time before Hill Street.
Yeah, and I love that episode of Mad Men that was about the Defenders abortion episode.
Yes. Yes, you know, and all of this stuff ties in. It is fascinating to me how it uses itself. There was an episode just last year of The Americans on FX, which had all of its characters, you know, during the Reagan era, watching The Day After on their TV sets.
Right, I remember that, yes.
And it's like, thank you for remembering TV and incorporating it.
And the impact that a show like that used to have. And that's something, as we were talking about earlier, that will never happen again. There'll never be a show like Roots in which, you know, 75% of people with TVs are watching it. You know, that's never going to happen again.
I know. And I think we are not the richer for it. I mean, I bemoan, I don't know if I bemoan, but I bitch a lot about the fact that we don't have this shared communal experience anymore the way we used to, that we aren't watching the same TV, much less watching it at the same time.
Yeah, TV used to be a thing that brought us together. You know, in the earliest days of TV, people stood in front of the window of the TV place and watched it, you know. And
yeah,
or they went, you know, we all went to one person's house that had a TV. And now TV like drives people apart. Everybody has their own set of headphones and their own thing, and they're in their own place.
It's on the biggest change is when you fly these days and you look around.
Yeah,
everybody's got a device and everybody's doing something differently.
Yeah, remember when they just used to show an edited movie on the plane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you only had a couple of choices, or you had to talk to the people next to you.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah.
Thank God for a noise-canceling headphone.
I know.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is from the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're chatting this week with historian, television critic David Bianculli. His new book is called The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific.
I was thinking about a particular controversial episode of the television series The Defenders, which was a marvelous... a legal drama that was on the same network at the same era as Perry Mason, and yet the acting was so much more naturalistic and the writing was so far superior. And they had this episode where a doctor gets himself arrested on purpose for performing an abortion so he can go on trial over it.
Yeah, think of how amazing that is. I mean, that's one of those plots that would be controversial now.
They would never do it now.
Yeah.
Just like they would never do the Maud episode that you mentioned.
The Maud abortion, yeah. It's for, and that's another thing that I show in class, and I show All in the Family, and students cannot believe that the language that was shown in 1971 on CBS in All in the Family was shown on broadcast television. But these days, I have to sort of make sure they understand the difference between broadcast television and cable, because now it all comes from one source. It's all, you know, as far as a lot of students know, everything comes from Hulu, or everything comes from Netflix, or everything comes from their cable.
The words that Lenny Bruce got arrested for, nobody cares about. But the other words that he used that nobody cared about, now you could get arrested for.
Yes, that's true. And George Carlin is what, 5 for 7 now? I'm not sure.
That's right. You can say a lot of those things, thanks to NYPD Blue.
Yes.
I also find that the finest shows in the history of television have a much more... the look of the shows is part of their design. And the theme music, not just the theme music of the opening, but the music that runs through the show. I'm thinking of, you know, The Fugitive. One of the reasons that The Fugitive is so great is that it, you know, has this great look. It has this moody music that runs through the whole thing. It's like a film noir kind of.
Yeah, it is film noir, and it's also, it's got an absolute classic structure. I mean, divided into acts, and you've got William Conrad as the narrator, and you've got that stentorian music, and David Jansen, I don't know if he smiled in the entire series run.
He could just, like, lift his eyebrow.
And... yeah, you know, and that's one type of TV show. And unlike most of the others, until you got to the end, even The Fugitives episodes were fairly interchangeable.
Yes, that's true. That doesn't have that continuity that we're talking about.
But at least it had the finale and introduced the idea of a TV finale in a drama to the point where now we can't end even a comedy series without a final episode just to give closure to the audience.
Mike Farrell told me, he was an actor on MASH, told me that when they wanted to do their final episode of MASH, the network didn't want them, the production company, whatever it was, didn't want them to do it because they said when The Fugitive did that, it killed The Fugitive in syndication. And there were anti-final episode. But, of course, now it's the way of the world, right? Every show has a final episode.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, MASH, if you end the Korean War, everybody's going to be upset and not want to see the comedy again.
Right.
You know, if that was a network executive argument, that was a stupid network executive, but they exist.
Now, I want to talk about two of my favorite Westerns, one that I love and one that I can't stand, Gunsmoke versus Bonanza. And here's why I think Gunsmoke is a platinum age of television kind of show.
Okay. All right. I'm with you.
All right. Gunsmoke, first of all, the way it looks, also shot in a beautifully cinematic way. Stuck with black and white for a long time, I think until the 12th season. The clothes that the actors are wearing look like the clothes that those people would wear. It's never tied up in a nice little bow. There's unexpected violence and fantastic actors who either are on their way down, you know, from the movies or on their way toward film careers, like Warren Oates and Bruce Dern and people like
right.
that. In Bonanza, it always looks like they're on a soundstage. It always looks like they just got their clothes off the rack. And it always seems like it was filmed in the 1960s. It doesn't feel like you're peeking into the...
No, I'm with you. With Bonanza, and there were certain formulas there that were laughable even at the time. Like if Little Joe kisses a girl, she's dead before the hour's up.
Right.
You know, that was always going to happen. And I show the pilot of Gunsmoke from 1955 to my students, and not only does John Wayne introduce it, but the hero, you know, Matt Dillon, they introduce the hero, and he gets in his first gun duel, and he loses.
Yeah,
and he's shot,
died.
And he spends the episode recuperating. You know, that wasn't done back then.
No.
It's rarely done now.
I was watching Gunsmoke the other day, and my wife said, oh, what happened in the end? I said, everybody died.
Yeah.
That's always what happens, you know? Or sometimes it just ends. That's one of the things I like. Speaking of The Fugitive, another QM production was The FBI. Now, The Fugitive had that look. It had that music. It seemed so real. Everything in The FBI is bright orange. And, you know, nobody...
I love this. You're a real student of television. This is terrific.
Nobody talks like they would really be talking, and they all drive Fords. There's never a Volkswagen on the street. Every car is a Ford.
And, you know, it's It's very Dragnet-like, and you know, it's the same sort of no-nonsense procedural, and these guys are supposed to be real, total, 100% undiluted heroes. No-nonsense guys.
Right. And they don't have any flaws.
Yes.
Dragnet was a fantastic show on the radio because it's people standing around talking. But then on TV, it's people standing around talking.
It's people standing around talking.
Interesting. You point
but
out.
It is fun. It is fun when they revive the show in the 60s and in color with Dragnet 67. You know, these were people writing about the problems of the time, and the problems of the time, as they saw it, were young people. And so they had to write about hippies. And
there's
and
an LSD
drugs
episode,
and rock and roll, and they got all of it so wrong that those shows are a blast to watch.
They're funny, unintentionally funny. But I do think Jack Webb was quite a brilliant guy.
Oh yeah, no, he was one of the early visionaries and a major hyphenate who sort of said, okay, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and at the same time I'm going to do this. So I'll act, I'll write, I'll produce, I'll edit, and I'll swing that hammer down at the end of the credits, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know that he did that, but, you know.
It might have been him.
Yes.
Well, you know, I think it was Fred Allen who once said, you know, television is called a medium because it's rare when it's well done.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the thing. You know, you point out that there are, in fact, right now, while we're talking, we're missing lots of television. There's like 400 shows on right now. There's more television on than there's ever been, which also means that although there's all this wonderful stuff that you talk about, there's just as much crap as there ever was.
Right, yeah. The percentage, if you're lucky, the percentage is like, you know, it's 10% good, you know, in any art form at any time. If either the most popular 10% isn't even necessarily the good 10%, I think in television, you have an astounding amount of popular TV that also happens to be good. If you compare it to the bestsellers on you know the New York Times you know book list or to the box office in terms of movies, the most popular isn't necessarily the best. But regardless of whether the best is the most popular, the best is only about 10% of what's out there.
And popularity is never a measure of whether a show is quality, or quality is never a measure of whether a show will be successful.
Yes, that's true.
Gary David Goldberg's Brooklyn Bridge, for example.
Which was fabulous. Yeah. You know, shows that still aren't out on DVD or available to be seen streaming. You know, and every once in a while, every few years, one of them will come out, like The Wonder Years, just a couple of seasons ago, finally came out on DVD.
No, the season one of The Defenders just came out. Recently.
And, you know, the Saint Elsewhere.
Yeah, that's not
except
out
for season one is still not out there.
Yeah, what the hell?
I know.
Aren't you in charge? You're, I don't know.
Too many music cues, too much, you know, but it's like just
right.
either strike a deal with the unions or charge more for it. Just do it.
You're right. I guess that's what held up those shows that Time
yep.
Life has out, like Wonder Years and China Beach and so forth, because they used good music.
And at some point, they'll release them, like WKRP in Cincinnati, and swap out some songs for other songs. I don't like that either. I don't like that either. It's not fair.
They even, in one season of The Fugitive, they had changed the music from the original music to something else. And the outcry was so great that they went back and did it again and let you send back.
Good for the people who outcried.
Yeah. All right, so I want to talk about, speaking of outcry, I want to talk about one of the most derided series in history, and that's The Beverly Hillbillies.
Okay.
And the thing about The Beverly Hillbillies, unlike many of the shows that were on at the time, like Petticoat Junction and lots of other shows, The Beverly Hillbillies is funny, really, really funny. It's got great guest stars like Charlie Ruggles and Wally Cox, but mostly it's got this core cast of really good actors who were very funny.
I don't disagree with you. I show the pilot of The Beverly Hillbillies, and, you know, students are prepared to not like it. And after a while, it it warms them up, because it is a fairly well-written and well-performed show. But, you know, it's not like I would use Gilligan's Island as an example. There are, in my mind, two reasons to watch Gilligan's Island.
And I know just what they are.
Yes.
Ginger and Marianne.
Yes, exactly.
I know, and one was supposed to be beautiful and one was supposed to not be beautiful, and I never got that.
Yeah, no, it's like they were both worth watching. And I have a website called TV Worth Watching, so I know whereof I speak.
Well, you know, before I got any of the jokes on Laugh-In, I got Judy Garland and Goldie Hawn. That registered right away.
Yes,
they're throwing
yes.
a bucket of water on a girl.
And, you know, and programs, you know, and I'm sure that female viewers at about the same time had people like, you know, Robert Conrad in the Wild Wild West or Napoleon Solo in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. had people that they could point to and say, oh my, okay, that's why I'm watching this show.
That was another bit they used very well in Mad Men, if you recall. There's an episode of Mad Men where Sally Draper, the main character in Mad Men, is watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E. on a couch. She's at an overnight at her friend's. She's watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Ilya is in bondage and she gets excited.
Yeah.
And the mother walks in and gets all mad.
I know. But it's fun.
Yeah. I do think Mad Men towers above most things. I think Mad Men was really an outstanding program. Do you agree?
I do, too. And I was really proud of the people I was able to speak to for the book about quality TV. I mean, I got to talk to Matt Weiner of Mad Men. I got to talk to David Chase of The Sopranos. And, you know, it is exciting to be able to have those levels of conversations with people like David Simon and just people whose work I admired so much through all the years.
Was there anyone that you asked and they said, no, I'm too busy to talk to you, David?
Schedules didn't work out for some people, yeah. I'll say one because I really regret that she wasn't in there was Tina Fey. And it just didn't work out.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Tonight we're chatting with David Bianculli. His new book is called The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific.
David Bianculli, do you think that the variety show will make a comeback, the type of variety show that Ed Sullivan once did? Vaudeville on television?
I don't know. It makes sense to me, but I think that we have a generation that with everything from YouTube on, nobody has the patience or few people have the patience to sit still for things in which they're not already interested.
That's kind of sad, isn't it?
Yes, it's very sad. To me, the best special that's on TV each year is the Kennedy Center Honors, and it'll be coming up, you know, at the end of December, and they bury it in that week between Christmas and New Year's when the ratings don't matter and they think nobody's watching. But it's remarkable. And usually of the people honored, there's one artist, you know, from ballet, from opera, from somewhere that I'm less familiar with than the others, and I'm always astounded by them and so grateful to have been exposed to their artistry and to the people celebrating them. And then the ones that I know, it's just gravy. But where is that on TV? Where do you get to learn about new stuff? A lot of the comics, a lot of the artists, a lot of everybody that I loved as a teenager, I loved because I saw them on the Smothers Brothers.
Right, yes. And they were so, as you've pointed out in both of your books, the Smothers Brothers show was so great. And I know you've written more than two. Sorry, the last book.
It's all right. It's okay. It takes me a long time. Two in this generation.
You point out how they mixed it up, how they'd have Betty Davis and Simon and Garfunkel or whatever it was on the same program. And I loved that, too. But also because, you know, that's one of the things about people our age is we were alive in a world in which Sophie Tucker and Jimmy Durante and lots of other performers were still around and still vibrant performers. Whereas, you know, after the Beatles, a certain kind of thing happened in show business where pretty much all stuff that's happened since then is in the same basic genre. There's not this, you know, last vestige of an earlier era anymore. Those people are all gone.
That's really interesting. You know, I mean, I don't know that I thought that much about that, but it has the ring of truth. I remember growing up, and my parents only had a few long-playing records, you know, and they were either show tunes or Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned to really like Frank Sinatra through that. Even though I was well aware that even though he was still around, still on the radio, still having hits at some point, that he was theirs, not mine. That, you know, the Beatles were mine.
Right. But, you know, I think, and if you play something off the radio right now, some contemporary record, I don't know, Lady Gaga or Beyonce or something, and then you play a Beatles song, that doesn't sound like from a million years ago. They go together. But think back about, okay, so let's say it's 1965 and you played something from 1925, you know, Gene Austin or Al Jolson, that's
right.
Going to be like from 100,000 years before.
It's true. And another thing is that if you go back to, like, you listen to the number one songs from 1962 or 1964, the range of music that was played on AM radio back then was phenomenal compared to, you know, all of us of that era. We were exposed to soul, to country, to rock, to novelty, to all sorts of things.
Right. I mean, we had Jack
even
Jones.
Instrumentals.
And, right. It's instrumentals, right. We had all that stuff. You know, it didn't matter, you know, if it was you would hear back to back, right? You'd hear Glenn Campbell doing Wichita Lineman, and you'd hear, you know, Moore, and then you'd hear Winchester Cathedral, and then you'd hear Incense and Peppermints, you know, like just all pushed together.
And I think that's healthy. I think it's regrettable that everything is so fragmented now.
Even in radio, although it seems like there's so much more radio, and it's so much because there's, you know, it's internet radio, and you can go to Spotify and whatever. But all of those things are formatted. So if you go to Pandora, it's still going to be formatted. It's not going to give you those things mixed up.
Yeah, it's ultra formatted, and it will let you hear only more of what you say you'd like, which you find new stuff that way. But it's new stuff in a very narrow range. I do like, there are some programs on like Sirius XM radio, like when Bob Dylan used to do his Theme Time Radio Hour, Tom Petty is doing Buried Treasure now, where, you know, he just dives into his own record collection, and it's eclectic enough so you don't know where he's going. We need more of that, not less of that.
Which brings me back to television, David Bianculli. His book, The Platinum Age of Television, is what we're talking about. Theme songs from great shows. Sometimes I think the theme, like we were talking about Boston Public earlier, that music, and I can't figure out why they had that music on that show. I couldn't stand that theme. I never liked the theme to Medical Center. That theme has nothing to do.
I don't even remember the theme to Medical
Center. It was like the theme, it was kind of like a cop show kind of, you know, SWAT kind of disco-y kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's okay to play against Timing Hill Street. Was a famous against type kind of theme song as an instrumental, but
it was sort of serious. It gave you a.
But it worked. It worked. But I'm with you. I think that theme songs properly chosen and performed set the table. They're almost like little appetizers to say, you know, here, now you're in for some fun. You know, The Sopranos had a great opening theme.
Oh, yeah.
When Saint Elsewhere play, I listened to that Dave Grusin instrumental at the start of each Saint Elsewhere, and I just got happy because I knew I was in for an hour of great TV, and it sort of was my introduction each week.
It's kind of sad that, I guess, to make room for more commercials, that they don't have, you know, themes anymore. You were mentioning in The Good Wife, you'd be watching The Good Wife, and you realized you'd been watching for 14 or 13 minutes before they suddenly flashed the title card. It's The Good Wife.
Yeah, but then, but they sucker me in every single time, but there's no full theme. And by the way, I don't think the reason is because they want to get one more 30-second ad. I think it's because they're so afraid that people are going to change channels that they do away with the idea of a theme song because it's too repetitive. And I think that's so wrongheaded.
I love the theme, for instance, in Elementary, and I loved the House MD theme also.
Yes, and right now, I mean, one of the most popular sitcoms on TV is The Big Bang Theory, and people sit through that theme song and like it. You know, it's old-fashioned. It's the way theme songs used to be.
I once went to a taping of All in the Family, and right before...
Did you?
Yeah, and right before the show, Carol O'Connor wheeled out a piano, and they got it. Archie and Edith went up to the piano, and they sang this song for us.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. I love that theme.
Well, you got me on that. I never saw a taping of All in the Family. I went to the Ginger Man restaurant that Carol O'Connor owned once for a dinner that he held, and interviewed him privately for a while, but I never got to see the show.
Well, wasn't it a great show?
Yeah.
Well, and that one definitely would feel at home. That would be a hard show to do now, I think, wouldn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, in these politically correct times. You know, but you think that it came on in 1971 when the country was so divided, but the country's pretty divided right now.
I heard that.
Yeah. At least half of us think it is.
I learned when I was reading The Platinum Age of Television that I am not alone in this particular habit of mine. When I was a kid, I woke up before television came on the air. And one of my favorite shows, I called it The Whistle.
Okay.
And it was the test pattern. It was a picture of an Indian.
Oh, The Whistle. Oh, that's great.
And he had numbers on his...
Yeah.
Oh.
I just
sit there and watch that thing. And conversely, the most depressing program was the national anthem that ended the broadcast
day. Yeah, your TV was going away. Your TV was stopping for the night. What a foreign idea that is. But that was so much fun, again, interviewing all these people and having so many of them have memories of getting up early on Saturday morning, you know, of a certain age, baby boomers and after, and having that ritual. And I realized after talking to a bunch of them, this was the only time when we were young that we controlled the one TV in the house. Otherwise, the parents had control of the dial. But Saturday morning, they were either sleeping in or doing something else, and you got to watch what cartoons or what live-action shows you wanted to see, and you sat there with your cereals and with your treats and, you know, with your friends or by yourself, and you didn't think of going outside for a while.
You know, David Bianculli, you're in this book more than you were in your previous book.
I know. That was a conscious and somewhat reluctant decision, but I'm glad I did it.
Well, me too. And I think all of our readers will be too. The book, and it's a monumental achievement, The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific, and the author, my guest, David Bianculli. Thanks so much for chatting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks a lot. It's rare that I get to talk with someone who loves and knows TV, obviously, as much as I do. So thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, David Biancooley. His new book is called The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific, and you can find him at tvworthwatching.com. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.